This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu's In Focus podcast. Today, we have a special crossover episode featuring The Hindu's Pale, a weekly podcast that brings together subject experts to discuss issues of public interest in depth and from multiple perspectives. In this bonus episode from the Pale podcast, we have our host Prashant Perumal in conversation with Surjit Bhalla and Jayati Ghosh on whether poverty has really dropped below 5% in India. We hope you like this episode. You can subscribe to Pale by The Hindu from the links in the show notes.
Hello everyone, welcome to Pale, The Hindu's weekly discussion podcast. I'm Prashant Perumal, your host for the day. Niti Aayog CEO Mr. B.V.R. Subramanian recently claimed that less than 5% of Indians now live below the poverty line in India. He made the claim based on findings of the recent Household Consumption Expenditure Survey, which is conducted by the National Sample Survey Office. Mr. Subramanian argued that the average consumption expenditure in the bottom 5% of India's population, as estimated by the survey, is about the same level as the level of the poverty line in India. So he suggested that the poverty line in India, the actual poverty in India is somewhere in the range of 0 to 5%. So to discuss Mr. Subramanian's views on the poverty line and stuff, we have Ms. Jayati Ghosh, who's a development economist and an author of the most recent book called The Making of a Catastrophe, The Disastrous Economic Fallout of the COVID-19 Pandemic in India. We also have with me Mr. Surjit Bhalla, who's a former member of the Prime Minister's Economic Advisory Council. Welcome to both of the guests. And I'll start with the first question directed towards Mr. Bhalla. Mr. Bhalla, like when a common man hears this view of Mr. Subramanian that just 5% of Indians live below the poverty line, that seems pretty unbelievable. So why does Niti Aayog say that? So can you give an explanation of how exactly the poverty line is defined in India and what is the poverty line right now in terms of figures? And do you think the poverty line needs to be raised?
I find it strange that you say it is unbelievable because we are talking about the change in poverty or the level of poverty today, which is, I think, I'll come to that level. But in 2011-12, the poverty level in India, according to the same poverty line, was 12.5%. So 12.5% is now down to 5% according to Niti Aayog, and that you consider unbelievable. Well, that suggests that we have not grown at all. If you look at the data released, the 5% is not a correct estimate of the poverty line because of the poverty level, because what they have released are fractile, are by percentile, by 0 to 5, 5 to 10, etc. If you apply the poverty line, which is today close to 1,500 via the Tendulkar poverty line and 1,800 in the urban areas, you get something close to 2% poverty level, not 5%. And then, therefore, we have moved from something like 12.5% in 2011-12 to 2% in 2022-23. And that definitely suggests that the poverty line needs to be raised around the world. The World Bank is the dean of this. They decide. But bottom line is that the extreme poverty is what has been eliminated when it's below 1% or 2%. Actually, the 2% rural and less than 1% urban gives you something like 1% or so, which is the absolute poverty level. So we've made good progress, but it definitely suggests that we have to raise the poverty line, and we can all have a discussion as to what the poverty line should be. What I can say is that these very same data, according to the lower middle income line, which is the World Bank lower middle income line, you get a poverty level of something like 25% in the urban areas and 11% in the 25% in rural areas and 11% in urban areas. So, which gives you something like 17 or 18 or maybe 20% poor, 21% to be precise. So that's now a 68% higher poverty line than what we have, which is the extreme poverty line. So I think we can have a debate on our discussion and decide what should be the poverty line, but there's no question that the poverty line needs to be raised. One last point, that you can decide whatever. So if I have a 100 rupees per capita per day poverty line, you'll get a higher poverty. If you have a 20 rupees per capita per day poverty line, you'll have zero poverty. So, you know, it's all a matter of what you society decides to be the poverty line. And last, that it is not at all incredible what you said, or not believable. It's more than believable what the data shows.
Thank you, Mr. Sujit. Ms. Ghosh, your views.
Yes, thank you. You know, I'm glad to see that Surjit and I are agreed that the whatever is being used as the poverty line today is inadequate. That I completely agree. But I just want to highlight a couple of things. First of all, officially, there is no declared income poverty line right now. What Surjit is using is the Tendulkar line applied, which was, you know, for 2011-12. Presumably then with the consumer price index, adjusted for the consumer price index over this period. And or relatedly, the World Bank's purchasing power poverty line of $2.15 a day, both of which would give you less than 5% extreme poverty or extreme destitution. However, there's a problem. You see, the Tendulkar line itself was not really conceptually based on anything. It broke away from the idea that you need a certain minimum calorie requirement to be fulfilled, and therefore households that spent at least that much on calories would be above the line and so on. It broke away from that, and it instituted really an approximation which took the urban poverty line, which seemed to be correct, and extrapolated that to rural, which is deeply problematic. So we don't actually have a poverty line in India. Let's be clear on that. The government has not announced any clear poverty line. We have several measures of multidimensional poverty, which are also problematic. The World Bank's PPP line is extremely problematic. There have been many criticisms, not just by me, but by Angus Deaton, Anthony Atkinson, Jean Barnett, who was one of the people in the World Bank who was actively involved in these processes. It's, you know, the PPP measures overstate the incomes of the poor. And conceptually, it's the fact that the poor earn low wages, which generates these very low priced goods and services, which are then used to say, well, actually, you're richer than you think you are because you can access low priced goods and services. It's a bit like telling women in households where they do a lot of unpaid labor that you are richer than you think you are because you're getting the free unpaid services and goods provided by your unpaid labor. But also, I just want to mention that this particular survey, and we have to be very careful when we're looking at comparing the survey over time, because the official report of it, the fact sheet that the NSSO has come out with, makes it explicit that this is not comparable with earlier surveys. There have been changes in the questionnaires, changing in the sampling criteria for the second stratum, the inclusion of repeat visits, 3 visits per household, which was never done in the past, with no account of dropout rate, inclusion of many commodities and services, exclusion of a whole bunch of others. Until we know all the details of that, we won't really know exactly what has changed and what those implications are. And also it means that we absolutely cannot compare over time, which is very unfortunate, because ideally the NSS should have done both, done a process which allows us to compare over time. And then if they want to change the methodology, fine, give us something which they think accurately represents the reality today. But overall, I would say there is really no basis for saying that it's less than 5% poor.
Okay, Ms. Gosar, you mentioned the comparability issues, but still the HCES says that, you know, the expenditure has gone up like about 2.5 times since 2011-12. But a lot of critics, like over the years, have been pointing out that income levels of households has not really risen in tandem with, you know, the other growth figures, let's say GDP or whatever. But here we see that, you know, the HCES says that expenditure has gone up a lot and stuff. So what explains the gap between the income figures and the expenditure figures? And, you know, what could be the reason? Is it because people aren't earning that much, but they still want to spend a lot? Could there be some reason behind that?
Before answering that, I just want to clarify, and if you will, disagree with Jayati's interpretation of what the survey report does. Nowhere in the survey report does it say it is that 2022-23 is not comparable to 2011-12. They do state, second, the definition, that is the modified mixed reference period, everything has stayed the same as in 2011-12. What has changed is that there are three visits rather than one visit to ascertain the answers to the question. So, and I think that's a mega improvement around the world. Indeed, if you look at Europe, if you look at the US, they have diaries and they take a week's or 2 weeks, 2 weeks input into the diaries in order to find out what the expenditure is. So I think that's just quite erroneous to say it is not comparable, and is doubly erroneous to say that the report says that they are not comparable. What the report says...
Sorry to interrupt, Sujit. I'm going to read from page 4 of that report.
Yeah.
22-23 has undergone some changes as compared to the previous surveys on consumption expenditure. A brief account of these changes. They are under item coverage, changes in questionnaire, multiple visits for data collection, change in mode of data collection. These are required to be noted while comparing the results of HCES 22-23 with those of the previous surveys.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Where does it say it's not comparable?
Noted. You know, this is just the polite way. We all, Sujit, we all know what goes on with the statistical system nowadays. This is just the polite way of proper statisticians in the NSSO telling us that this is not comparable.
I don't know what the NSSO statistician is telling you. He hasn't told me or the public at large. He should tell the public at large. What you said was a report says this. That's categorically wrong.
Well, this is. I am reading from the fact sheet.
Yes, I'm reading. Where does it say it's not comparable?
It says these are the changes. Anyway, let's get on to Prashant's question.
I think the real listeners understand both your viewpoints and the disagreements that you have with the reading of the report itself. I think that's been registered.
You cannot have, she said categorically, it's not comparable, and the report says it's not comparable. There's nowhere in the report that it says that. That's all. It does mention changes.
Okay, Mr. Bala, we understand your point. Yeah, I think it's recorded. We're going to have it in record. So, yeah. Mr. Bala, the second question, if anyone of you can answer, but about the difference between...
Yeah, exactly. I'll answer that. Now, you had that basically it's gone up 2.5 times since 2011-12. Well, that's in nominal terms. Okay? So as economists, we all look at what's happened in real terms. That includes inflation. In real terms, consumption has gone up per capita by about 40% over the last 11 years. So I don't see what the problem with that is. That's what the data shows. And indeed, GDP per capita has gone up something like 60%. And as we know, one of the big celebrations of the Indian economy and what is to be congratulated is the investment. Investment rates today are back to the levels of 2000, the peak levels observed in 2011, 12, or between 2004 and 11. We all celebrated it then that, listen, and you know, people are saying we need investment. Well, we've got investment, infrastructure investment, et cetera. So the distinction between why is GDP gone up and this not gone up is primarily because the share of investment has gone up. So now, what else was your question? What are the other expenditures that corroborate this claim or the our understanding? Well, look at wages. And the PLFS provides you with wages of casual workers, of self-employed workers, and of salaried workers. Now, the casual workers in agriculture, so agricultural workers also, agricultural workers' wages have gone up 3.2% per year since 2011 and since 2017, and has gone up by 4.1% since for casual workers. So real wages have really gone up. Salaried workers, the PLFS shows that salaried workers have not shown any increase in wages, in real incomes. All this is real, adjusted for inflation. And what you do have is that the salaried workers, the tax data shows a reasonably strong, robust growth since 2011. And you can look at that, and that shows something like 2% per annum real increase in salaried workers' incomes. So you have tax data showing that incomes have gone up and therefore consumption has gone up. And you have the PLFS also showing that real wages have gone up.
Okay. And Ms. Ghosh, your counter to that?
Yeah. Yes. You know, it's unfortunate that we have to even keep disagreeing on data, but there are so many different studies, including my own, but others, that have looked at the real wage data. And real wages have grown by less than 1% per annum since 2017. They have fallen for construction workers. What's more important and also very significant is that the increase in employment that has been celebrated in the latest PLFS in 22-23 doesn't actually exist, because it's generally due to the dramatic increase in the unpaid family helpers, that is, people who work in family enterprises in unpaid form, dominantly women. At the moment, the PLFS shows us that 37.5% of women workers are unpaid, which is an increase from 32% in 2011-12 and 2017-18. If you look at only the paid employment rate, people who are working and getting paid for that work, it's only 48% for men and 13% for women. 13%. So we really do not have any indications that real wage incomes, that is wages into employment, are growing for most working families. Less than 1% per annum for this period of seven years, and had no increase in the paid employment rate. So the NSS is showing us that real consumption grew at around 3% per annum. Yes, private consumption is declining. But what's really happening here is a dramatically increased consumption of the top 10 to 15%. And that, I think, is widely documented. The fact that whatever consumption we have is driven by the upper deciles, by the top 10, maybe 15% of these groups. Remember, many of them are excluded from the NSSO survey. People do not go and interview Mr. Mukesh Ambani about his monthly consumption, for example. So generally, the rich tend to be excluded, and that's well known, that both tails of the distribution are excluded, but particularly the rich. But we have many other indicators of the demand for mass consumption goods. Fast-moving consumer goods, they're hardly increasing at all. It's stagnation in demand. Two-wheelers, the sales are less than they were pre-demonetization, that is, pre-November 2016. And yes, growth is now driven by capital expenditure, largely public capital expenditure, because we really haven't seen the same revival in private investment, largely because mass consumption demand is stagnant. It's not growing enough. But also, just to get back to this issue, you know, what are other living standard indicators? And since I still believe we cannot compare this particular NSS survey with the earlier surveys, let's at least compare this with some of the other indicators that suggest a minimum standard of living. So the central government, the lowest minimum wage for unskilled workers, I looked at the average of that across all the different regions, and it's 16,000 per month, which is the central government's lowest minimum wage. And of course, everything else is way above that. Let's assume a family of four. Then presumably 4,000 rupees per month per person is what the government might think is the minimum required consumption. Presumably that's why they have that minimum rate for central government workers. Now, note that this is significantly lower than the living wage as estimated by the ILO. But let's take that 4,000 per month. If you take that, then this particular survey tells us that 70% of rural households and 30% of urban households fall below this. And so if you want to take that as an indication of income poverty, perhaps that's a decent indication that it's well below the absolute minimum wage of the lowest category for unskilled workers of the government.
Mr. Balla, do you have a response to the whole argument about the unreliability of data and the objectivity of the government's data and the huge gap that exists between different figures? Your response, Mr. Balla.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you point out in your question about the unreliability of government data.
That's what the critics say. The critics, I mean, I'm just pointing out the critics' argument. I'm not personally making my opinion.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, I think we need a larger discussion and debate about the private sector data, some of which Jayati has used in sites. And the private sector data that I'm particularly concerned about is the CMIE data, which shows that female labor force participation rate in India is lower than that in Yemen, is lower than that in Iraq, at something like 9% of the women are working in India. So I think we need a debate on this. Second, regarding government data, we know that the 2017-18 PLFS, Consumer Expenditure Survey data were not released because of their very, very bad quality. Now, Jayati and I, that's the one thing we agree on, is that the government should have released that data, okay? But it doesn't negate the fact that that data was of an awful, awful quality, and the government has set up two committees since 2019, and their reports have yet to see the light of day for us to really comment. So first point, that the data of the private sector is perhaps much worse than the data of the public sector. Second, that there is a genuine problem with the 2017-18 Consumer Expenditure Survey, well acknowledged. And now we have the ILO saying that the 2017-18 and the 2018-19 PLFS survey is of such bad quality. They say it's not consistent with any other data. So we do have a genuine problem with the 2017-18, 2018-19 PLFS MOSPI data. So this is MOSPI data on consumption, etc., government data. After that, or excluding that, that our data are just as good or bad as any other country. Take, for example, the Consumer Expenditure Survey. In there, it captured, this survey captured something like 58% of national accounts consumption. Okay. In the US, for 30 years, they have the national survey to national accounts consumption ratio has stayed around 60%. Ours was 62% in 2011-12, and it's now 58-59%. So the quality of our data, excluding what happened in 17-18 and 18-19, are just as good or just as bad. Now, you know, Jayati makes a big point that Ambani was not consulted on his consumption. Well, what may come as news to her...
I mean, the rich are never consulted. The very rich are never consulted.
Let me finish. And, you know, this is a well-known problem. People have written volumes on it. Even I have written a book on it called Imagine There's No Country back in 2002. So what we need to look at is what has happened to the change in the survey to national accounts ratio. That has stayed the same, and that is the same as in the US. So what we can say is that, look, our quality of public data, excluding, as I said, the in-between period of 17-18 and 18-19, is just as good or just as bad, just as representative or just as unrepresentative as the US data. So I don't think there's a particular problem with Indian data. This is a problem with survey data around the world.
Okay.
Will you allow me to respond a little bit to this? So, look, I just want to point out that, no, I don't agree, because data in India now have been politicized like never before. The scrapping of the 2017-18 consumer survey, apparently because it was of poor quality, we have no means of knowing that. I mean, Surjit says it's poor quality. He may have access to information that none of us do, but we need to have that information then. We need to have the survey results. We need to see exactly what was wrong. Similarly with PLFS, what exactly is wrong? Let's hear the decent and valid criticisms on it. But look at the way the PLFS was not even released until after the 2019 elections. Look at the attack on the head of the council that produces the National Family Health Survey, because it came out with results on open defecation, et cetera, that were not to the liking of the government. Look at the suppression of many audit reports, like the Clean Ganga Mission. Look at the fact that we haven't even had a census yet, 4 years after we're supposed to have started this process. Look at selective publication of partial reports that do not provide all the usual details, whether it was the economic survey before the vote on account this year, which came out as more like a propaganda sheet than an actual economic survey, or even this particular report, which does not give us full results. It does not tell us the details. And I do believe that this is something that is of deep importance, because we had one of the best statistical systems in the world. Amazing for a lower middle income country. And for this to be destroyed in a very blatantly politicized way is a serious problem. I don't think we should just be casual about it and say, well, you know, it's our difference between the NSS and the survey data is the same as the US, so we have nothing to worry about.
Permission goes to your government. I mean, Mr. Subramanian argues that, you know, if you look at into the consumption patterns, you see that more people, even in the bottom half of the pyramid, are spending on things more than just basic food items, and more on, like, you know, milk and more, you know, more sophisticated food items. So isn't that a sign that, you know, things are actually improving in the country?
Oh, absolutely. This has to happen with any increase in income, right? This is not a surprise. And it certainly is valid. It's also true that as there is much more mechanization, much less in requirement of walking, etc., you need less of the cereals per se, and you should have a much more balanced and nutritious diet. But, you know, a new UN report that just came out yesterday, it says 74% of the Indian population cannot afford the minimum nutritious diet prescribed by the FAO for the South Asia region. That's a big sign. Definitely there's an improvement. I'm not saying there isn't, but we're still very, very far from a minimum goal. And we also don't know the distribution of this change in the pattern of spending. We've got the aggregates in this new survey. We haven't seen how it's changed for, let's say, the bottom half of the population. But clearly there is a problem if 74% of our people cannot afford the minimum nutritious diet. then I think that we still have to be deeply concerned about the state of nutrition in the country.
Mr. Balli, your final comments. Yeah, we've got around like 4 minutes to go. Yeah.
First, you know, the data will be released. So therefore, let's wait until the unit level data and all the questions that Jayati has can be answered. On this nutritious diet, you know, back in 1980, I did a report for the World Bank. And at that time, you know, we all thought that calories were an important indicator of poverty, actually. There are books written on malnutrition and poverty. And a survey in the US at that time, which was reported in a World Bank paper, that basically 80% of American women were malnourished according to their caloric consumption, again, using FAO standards or the US standards. So I think we can manufacture our own statistic, and that's rather unfortunate, just because the UN, and at that time the World Bank, came out with reports that malnutrition was serious indication of, or calorie consumption to be precise, was a serious indication of poverty. So, and then the World Bank and the rest of us, we never had malnutrition or caloric consumption as an indicator of poverty. The World Bank did. And thankfully, the World Bank has changed and got to a absolute income level by which to define poverty, which I think is the correct method that they have used. So, you know, there are agencies that produce stuff and not enough. And if I can plug in my forthcoming book called How We Vote, which will be out in the first week of April to be published by Juggernaut, that does discuss this in some detail as to what the different indices are and how the different indices have a political bias. And this is not by me. I cite reports.
Have a last minute.
Yeah, final word, just 1 minute to Ms. Ghosh. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. No, I just want to highlight that, you see, nutrition is a very critical part of well-being, and I don't think there's any doubt about it. The indicator that is produced not just by the FAO, but by 12 UN agencies put together, does not rely on only calorie consumption. It is a much more sophisticated indicator that looks at a more balanced diet, and it looks at it for local regions. It looks at it in the South Asia context. And it's on that basis that they have realized that 2-3/4 of the Indian population cannot afford that. So it's not surprising that a lot of our nutrition outcome indicators are also not improving at the rate at which they should. For example, stunting in children and anemia in women. These are all outcomes of poor nutrition, among other things.
Mr. Balla, maybe like 20 seconds for you and then we're done. Yeah.
I just look, the entire discussion should be about change, not about levels. Because take, for example, nutrition. 74% are not nutritious according to whatever.
This is up from 71% 2 years ago.
No. What was it in 2011?
It was probably around 76%. They started measuring this only in 2015.
Okay. So then we can't really discuss that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. But it's a great, great discussion. I think it's the best parallel we've had, like, that I've personally done. It was really good. Thanks to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.